that Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, they just disagree on how.
We're gonna get across that wasteland, and we're gonna do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Line of Vienna Street podcast. My name is Tom Jenkins, and I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Manning for episode 144. As I'm sure you'll all have seen over the last couple of months, we've been hugely fortunate to be able to bring you podcasts with great guests from Bolton's past, and I hope you've all enjoyed listening to their stories. Today is no different. Our guest made 132 appearances for Wanderers and is fondly remembered as a cult hero with one of the most recognisable terrace chants ever. Please welcome Mark Fish. Mark, thank you for joining us today. I hope you've been keeping well despite everything that's been going on.
Yes, very much so. Thank you for having me. But also, I was when you introduced me, I was hoping that you would go fish. But anyway, but yeah, thanks very much.
I think if we had better microphones, Mark, we'd do that. Otherwise, it would deafen people, I think, at this stage. But no, I like to say, South Africa, I presume, is where you are at the moment now. It's one of my favourite countries. And as we spoke just before we started, you know, whether or not this situation has affected you greatly compared to how it's affected us over in the UK.
So obviously it's the same probably all over the world. But, you know, for us as South Africans, I think the challenge is, you know, we listen to the president and the ministers talking, and we're waiting for schools to reopen and what they're going to do. But mainly, we need people to start working. I think that's the biggest challenge, because we are a country where you have very rich people, very poor people, and the people survive on working. And if we can't work, then you obviously know what will happen from there. So I think they're having the discussion, and let's hope that we were at level 5. We went to level 4 2 weeks ago, and the president spoke 2 nights ago saying, okay, we're going to go to level 3, but they're going to sort of tell us the restrictions, what we can and cannot do.
Obviously, I know that you were been involved in the ANC and also a lot of charity projects. How has the coronavirus affected you from a working life perspective?
Well, it's more from, when I say working life, it would be more, I do a lot of projects on the farms in Limpopo. So going to the rural areas, it's difficult. We can't, you know, living in Pretoria, which is obviously not obviously, but in Gauteng, we have restrictions going to other provinces, if you want to call it that.
Yep.
And to go to Limpopo is quite difficult. So I have to find a new way of the projects that I do implement to do with the farm workers themselves. And this year we were hoping to introduce the schools as well. But with a challenge, we'll reinvent ourselves and make sure we do something that's creative and good, beneficial for everyone.
Absolutely. I don't think the world's going to be the same, is it, coming out of this in any format, whether that be personal life, private life, business, whatever. It's going to be a different world altogether. Sometimes it's a good opportunity to reset things, both sporting and personal, I suppose.
Definitely.
Yeah, I know that obviously you've had quite an involvement in football in South Africa as well, even prior to you sort of helping to get the 2010 World Cup there. But for me, football has always seemed like a tertiary sport behind cricket and rugby in South Africa when I visited it there. When you were younger, what made you pursue football instead of other things?
So I played football, cricket, and I went to an all-boys high school, and I was playing first-team cricket, and it just didn't seem that as exciting to me. I went to a high school that played rugby and cricket, didn't play football. But I played football for a club. So I played cricket at the school. And, you know, I just found myself playing cricket all day. The way it was structured, we played all day, never got a result. And carried on playing football. And when people actually found out, and this is the truth, when people found out, some of the reporters found out that I actually played cricket, they asked me, why did I choose cricket over football? And if I look back, what am I now, 46, if I look back a good 50 years ago, there were better looking girls watching football than there was cricket. Why chose football? It's honest truth.
Not in England, there's not.
No, but yeah. Anyway, but in South Africa, yeah, that was. But it was an easier route for me. I mean, I went to school and did what I needed to do. But football was in my blood, and I played for a club, which is obviously got me to play. Eventually, go on to wherever I went to.
Yeah, well, at least now, I suppose, now that football's ended, for you can get back into cricket quite regularly.
Nah, still not a big cricket fan. No, I can't. You know, if you watch cricket, you can imagine if you actually played, even if you played a one day, you could actually be in a team where you don't actually even touch the cricket ball if you're on the field. So maybe you're not a bowler, you're a fielder. The ball doesn't come to you. And then next minute your team bats and you bat low enough in the batting lineup. You don't touch a ball. So no, I'm not a big cricket fan at all.
I feel the same. I'm far too impatient to play cricket myself. Far too impatient.
It's one of those things, and I think you either love it or you hate it, regardless of what country you're in. I'm interested to know, Mark, obviously, when you started playing football over there for Joma Cosmos and Orlando Pirates, what kind of quality there was in the South African League at the time?
So, obviously, we go back to the political situation in South Africa, you know, leading up to 94. You know, we had football, and if you look at the history of South Africa, you had white football teams playing against black football teams, playing against Indian, playing against coloured, and this all leading up to, you know, up to 94 for the first democratic elections. You know, I played for a football club, fortunately played for a football club that was the first football club to have a black player play for them. So at a professional level, let's call it semi-professional at the time. But so growing up as a youngster, I played for a club called Acadia Shepherds from the age of 6 till 17, till I moved to Joma Cosmos. We had black players playing there for us. So I never knew any different. If it makes sense, it never bothered me color. But obviously, when going to school the next day, there were only white kids. So it was. I look back and it's, you know, people talk about apartheid. And it's a big thing, obviously, in South Africa, because we like to... Unfortunately, people live in the past. We can't move on. And, you know, for me, the challenge is I just played football, whether I was playing at the age of 6, whether my first game for Joma Cosmos going to play in the townships, where they are, if you just want to say black people. People ask me, but aren't you scared? And I said, no, we're playing football. Football is the leveler. Football brings people together. And people go to football stadium to watch you play football, no matter who you are, where you come from.
It always seems to me, yeah, no, it is absolutely, because I quintessentially almost, and it seems very, very horrible to generalize, but it seemed as though a lot of the imports that we get over in this country from South Africa, for example, or the players that seem to make it, tend to be black players, for example. And I think it always seems to, from an outsider looking in, that maybe the white kids were sort of pushed towards playing cricket and rugby, whereas football was left to be played in the townships. Has that changed much over the last 20 years or so?
So again, the challenge is that for the last 26 years, if you say talk about the first democratic elections, you know, I think I was talking to someone the other day about it. But the challenge for us in the apartheid era, where you know we didn't have football because of what the world said, you know, this is apartheid. But you know, rugby, they still played the one or two games against New Zealand, but New Zealand wasn't called New Zealand; they were called the Cavaliers. And then cricket, they also played the Rebel Tour. They played against Australia. But football never did that. So even now, you know, football's being played. We are 55 million people in South Africa. The majority is black, if you want to say that. What football has lost in this country is through school sports. You know, going to school at a primary level, you can play football, rugby and cricket. Those are the three big sports. But when you go to a high school, they only give rugby and cricket. And this is what happens in South Africa, because we're talking about an education point of view, where if I'm white, black, coloured, whatever, I want my kid to have the best education. And unfortunately, in those schools, they don't give football. So we lose a lot of whatever colour to cricket and rugby because of the situation in the country. And so whether I say, and we've had a couple of fly halves that played for provincial rugby and you listen to their story. Even the great Herschel Gibbs. Now, the great, you know who Herschel Gibbs is, South African cricketer?
Absolutely, yeah. What a fantastic fielder.
Yeah, no. Yeah, he lost us the World Cup. We won't mention that. But
couldn't help myself. Sorry, Mark.
No. But Herschel himself played under 16 SA schools with me, football. So he was a fantastic footballer. But he ended up choosing cricket. And I think if you listen to his story, he realized, and he was an unbelievable rugby player. They wanted to sign him here, in a provincial team here in South Africa. But he ended up choosing cricket because they found out that he had a knee problem. And obviously, cricket is a little bit more or less on the knees than rugby and football. So we still have those issues. But our biggest problem with football is that whether it's at the school level or federation, is that, you know, if you look at our cricket may do well at a when they play test cricket and one day, but when you go to a World Cup, it's like the British press, where they put so much pressure on the team that the team doesn't perform. So we've had that with cricket. The rugby, they've changed things in rugby. They've gone according to the government and whatever they've done. And you saw, sorry to say, unfortunately, we come to England in the World Cup final last year. And then football, unfortunately, you know, the people running football are still stuck in the olden days, you know, and they run football like that like it's their own, and things mustn't change. And unfortunately, there's so much money in football in South Africa that they don't ever want to look at change. Or when I say change, meaning people within the structures, whether it's SAFA, the governing body, or even the local league, the PSL. So it's a challenge. I just think that many kids want to play. Kids should be able to be given the choice of what sports they want to play. And unfortunately, we don't really have that in South Africa.
Yeah, it seems like it's almost held it back a little bit because, you know, all the time now we see a lot of African teams coming to World Cups and whatever and doing really, really well. But apart from the 2010 World Cup, it seems as though South Africa has been held back a little bit. Obviously, you played in the 96 Africa Cup of Nations team that won that tournament. That must, I imagine, it almost must be a bit disappointing that your team was playing then rather than in the 2010 World Cup, when I imagine they would have done a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, certainly. And unfortunately, again, we can compare ourselves to UK, where you won the World Cup in 1966, and people always refer to that. And unfortunately, that's, again, you know, whenever anyone talks about football, they will talk about 96 and they will talk about the team, because people want to relate to success. And I'm 96. 96. I was 21, turning 22. I'm now 46. I don't really want to hear about 96. It's gone. Let's move on. Unfortunately, we haven't. You know, we had the African Nations Cup in 96, like you said. We won that. 98, we came second. We lost to Egypt in the final. And in 2000, we lost to Nigeria in the semifinals, and we ended up coming third. So those three African nations should have been something for us as a football federation to build on, not to sit back and go, okay, now we've arrived. We haven't arrived. And unfortunately, now we are trying to play catch up with the rest of the continent. And as you mentioned earlier, unfortunately, we play catch up with the rest of the continent, but the continent itself is falling behind, because the last World Cup, unfortunately, we didn't have an African team go through to the next round. And that's sad, because then we know we are falling behind, not only, we're falling behind to the rest of the world, how we play. Yes, you can have the phenomenal individuals, the Sadio Manes, the Mo Salahs, whoever you want to mention, but we as a continent need to change the way we think and the way we play football. And if you want to compare it, let's talk about the English League. The English League, you know, when I played there, you had a lot of foreigners coming in, but the foreigners lifted up the game. Now, you still got foreigners. Yes, certainly foreigners coming in, but you've got foreign coaches coming, changing the way that you play the game, the way you think about the game, and look what it's done for the English national team. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're playing a style of football. If I had asked you 10, 15 years ago, would you play that style of football? You probably would have said no. But look at the stuff. You're playing football that's second to none, and getting relative success from it. So we're still stuck in the dark ages. Yeah, and you know, our challenge is, you've got people that's been there they don't want to let go, and we just need someone. We need someone like a good face, a good person that is respected, like a Lucas Radebe that was at Leeds United.
Yeah, fantastic player.
Put him as the president, and then get people around him to support him. And let's change the way we think about the game. The way we think about the game is so key in South Africa, because we have our football, and yes, we can, you know, the big game we have is Kaizer Chiefs against Land of Pirates. That's 90,000 people that go and watch. So people love football, but the football that they watch is what they love. But we're not qualifying as a country. We're not really struggling to qualify for African Nations Cup. We're not even qualifying for World Cups. So there's something wrong.
And I was interested to ask Mark, if you don't mind just interrupting, apologise. Looking, doing a bit of research beforehand in the makeup of the most recent international squad. I mean, going back in the day, you talk about 96 towards 98. I was sort of 13, 14 and just starting to learn about world football. And the names that you talk about, like Sean Bartlett, Lucas Radebe, yourself, people like that would come from South Africa and leave and play abroad. The most recent squad I could find online only had sort of 6 or 7 members of that squad that played outside of South Africa. Do you think that there's a change in the mentality in the player, in not willing to move abroad, or are the opportunities not there?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that when you had the my late friend, Philemon Musinga, you know, him and Luke,
Leeds,
two guys that went to Leeds. So we left the country because, you couldn't make a living out of football in South Africa. So they created the APSA Premier League here in South Africa. So players get paid very well now. So you don't necessarily have to leave.
Okay.
But you do have some youngsters that leave. But again, I think it's just the mentality. And I think what has happened is that, unfortunately, yeah, in South Africa, you get teams like Orlando Pirates, Kaizer Chiefs, Mamelodi Sundowns. I use those three big teams because they can get paid such good money, or because they get paid such good money, they think that playing for their club and playing for the country is the same. They don't get it. So
right.
There's no comparison where, you know, at I was now with the national team in Egypt when we beat Egypt in Egypt, which was phenomenal performance by the team itself. But you have players, the squad, fighting with the president of the federation about money and about jersey, which we had in 96 or 92, even when we got readmitted to world football. So there, I mean, things like that haven't changed. So our backs are against the wall, but yeah, I don't know. Something needs to happen. And it's sad to say, but you probably need these, the old people running the federations and the Premiership, you need them to pass on before.
Yeah, and a modernization, absolutely, a modernization of that. I was surprised as well, just to make one final point about the national team, looking at recent squads, there don't seem to be too many young players in there, by which I mean, you know, sort of like 19, 21, 22, 23. I think the last couple of squads I looked at, I think Lebo Matiba was the oldest, the youngest at 25. Yeah. Is that a problem in South Africa with young players?
That's the biggest problem in South Africa. You know, South Africa, we don't think that you get a young player, and we use, off the top of my head, you think of someone, is it Wayne Rooney, that, you know, or playing in the Premier, no, he was 16, wasn't he?
That's right, and for England not long after, 18 months after.
And then he's playing for his national team. So in South Africa, we don't, you know, and don't mean to say it, but, I mean, I made my debut for South Africa at the age of 19. You had Quinton Fortune that played United. Also was very young. So there's been a couple of young players. But we in South Africa, unfortunately, the players develop later. So when they go and you ask someone, you go, gee, he's a young player, he's a good player. And you ask him how old he is. Then they'll go, no, he's 22, 23. I'm like, that's not young. So our mindset needs to change.
Interesting.
We need to really attack the age of 15. When I say age of 15, meaning the teenagers, when a boy is turning from 30, 40, 15, you can emotionally, physically develop them. And that's what we need to do. And we don't do enough of it, or something goes along. But again, there's so much, and age cheating. Age cheating is a big problem. Not in South Africa, but in the whole continent. It's a problem. I know CAF is doing a lot of work about it, and they're trying to eradicate it, and they are doing a lot of good work, But, you know, unfortunately, yeah, in South Africa, a player can be X amount, you know, anywhere in the world. You'd rather buy a so-called 21-year-old player when he's actually 25, you know, so that's what they get away with, yeah. And you can see it. You can see it when a guy plays, and he plays for 3 or 4 years, he's phenomenal. After that, he's meant to be 25, but he's actually 29, and he's struggling with injuries, sure. And you think, yourself, okay, there. So, money's become a problem, and the dedication to the national team, I think, is an issue where it was, you know, and the best thing that could have happened is CAF went online with FIFA, and I don't know if you remember, when I was playing at Bolton, remember, we didn't have the same calendars. So
that's CAF, right, yeah, the mid-season for the Brit, yeah.
Yeah, so, Colin Todd didn't really enjoy it that I had to come back that season in the Premiership to come play for the national team, I think, which was the 96, so 97, 98. So the beginning of 98, I mean, we had the African Nations Cup. So I was missing for three, four weeks. So, but that was the good thing that happened on the same calendar. But there's many things that we need to look at as South Africans, and why are other countries on the continent doing better than us when we've got all the infrastructure, we've got enough money behind the sporting code? Why are we not competing with the rest of the continent as we should be?
Did you feel, Mark, that you sort of had to leave when you were younger to be able to develop yourself as a player, given that there seemed to be an issue with South African clubs being almost stuck in the past? I know there were quite a few offers on the table for you before you made the move to Lazio. I even believe that Manchester United were in there looking at you.
So, yeah, and even the year before. So, in 94, when I signed for Orlando Pirates, the club owner called me in and said, listen, yeah. And so, Harry Redknapp wanted me to come to West Ham. And then I sort of said, nah, I'd rather just stay to develop myself a little bit more. And then the next year as well, 95. And then the chairman called me again. And then he said he wants me to stay. And it was fortunate because Harry Redknapp came again, but he asked me to stay because we fortunately went on as Orlando Pirates to go on to win the African Champions League as a club. So, which was good. But the United thing was after the African Nations Cup, the people representing me said, okay, Man United and Lazio. So I went to United and I actually watched Man United against Everton when Kanchelskis actually had left Man United. He went to Everton. He was playing for Everton. Remember Kanchelskis?
I do, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Fantastic winger. So
he was playing, and it was a Monday night, watched the game, sat with Alex Ferguson in his office, and he said, no, you know, he had been referred to me, by Sir Bobby Charlton, who had flown out to watch me play in the African Nations Cup. And he just said, no, he wants me to stay, not on trial, but just to train with them and see how I adapt to the surroundings. And then the people representing me just said, okay, well, we're not saying no, but we're under obligation to go to Lazio as well. And went to Lazio, and the coach there was Zednik Zeman, and he just wanted to sign me straight away. And as you said earlier, I mean, Manchester, Lazio, Rome, I don't know, let's just go. I was 21 years old, really. It's not really a choice.
It's not a bad decision. Not a bad decision to have to make is between two of them places.
No, and I was single as well, so yeah, you can imagine.
A bit of an external motivator for you there, Mark. Then.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I know, Chris, you're desperate to talk to him about 90s Italian football, so I'll let you lead the way on talking about the likes of Nesta, Negro and Cavalli at the back of that defence.
For definite, and I don't want to hijack it too much with talk or anything other than Bolton, but like Tom says, I'm an absolute addict of the mid-90s Serie A. Those are some of the names in the team that you played for. I know with Zeman in charge, famously chain-smoking his way through matches. Some of the players that you played alongside, you know, the main names like Nedved and Nesta and people like that. But I'm also interested if you've got any particular memories of the time around in the stadium. I mean, I've been out a couple of times to see games, and it, not quite as glamorous as it seems on the TV when you turn up to the grotty, rotten old stadiums.
No, for sure. Obviously, I mean, you know, you go from, as you sorry to say, from earlier, so I played for a club, then went to Jomo Cosmos, you're playing, now next minute you've got some, you know, a few fans watching, then you go to Orlando Pirates, is the second biggest supported team in the country, and I was still semi-professional then, playing for Orlando Pirates, where we trained three times a week, and then obviously played either Saturday or Sunday. And then at the African Nations Cup, and then next month you go to Italy and you're training twice a day. My roommate was Marcajani, who was the goalkeeper. He was my
Roommate. Of course, Luca Marcajani. Yeah,
he could speak the best English. You say Nesta. Do you remember Chamot?
Jose Chamot, of course. Yeah.
So, and then Casiraghi and Signori, Fuse. So that was an unbelievable team. I mean, the unbelievable talents, and Zednik Zeman had us there. And unfortunately, what happened was that I got signed for them, got into the squad, and there's no better place to, as a defender, to go learn your trade. That is in Italy. So it was an eye-opener for me and an experience. But what unfortunately had happened is that we got off to not a good run. I don't think they expected us to do a lot better, but I got called up to we had a European 11 and African 11 play in Lisbon. And I got called up and I went to play in that match. And that was, it was a Tuesday I went through, and we played on the Wednesday. But on that Wednesday, they sacked Zedek Zeman.
Dino was off, wasn't it, I believe?
Dino was off, took over. And unfortunately, I got back, and by the time I got back, you know, Dino Zoff had taken training session and he changed the team, and they went out, and obviously they went on a really, really good run. So it stagnated my appearances for the club. But, it was fantastic memories, and the players themselves, yeah. I'm just fortunate that I wasn't there when Gazza was there, because I think it's been two of us together.
It's been a great fun, that, I have no doubt.
If I may just ask one more question, Tom, before we move on to talking about an actual big club in Bolton. what was it like training with Alan Boksic and Signori and Casiraghi and, I suppose, a young Marco Di Vaio as well as the attackers?
Well, no, so Boksic, remember, he was there for a while, then he had a fallout and he went to Juve. So
Boksic, of course, to the Champions League. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, it was Casiraghi and Signori. A fantastic experience playing with all these big players, but also, having a training ground for a club. You know, that was new for me, and having fans watching you train, and So just the way the club was run, that was the biggest experience for me. But like you said,
fantastic.
I have fond memories of you're playing next to a young Alessandro Nesta, and then I find myself going as a fan to the 2006 World Cup here in Germany, and you're watching this out play, and they win the World Cup, and it was phenomenal. So phenomenal memories, and the guys in the team were really good to me, and it's
fantastic.
I learned a lot as an individual about myself, because again, remember, you're going to Italy, it's a different lifestyle, it's obviously a lot more football, this and that, it was a eye-opener for me. But let me tell you something. So not many people know. So what had happened was that, so I signed for Lazio in February. I think it was late February. So they said I must be back June, July for pre-season, whatever. And we went back, and then the deal at the time was meant to be, so it was $2 million to the club, Lando Pirates, $1 million to, well, was $1 million to the club, $500,000 to me, and $500,000 split between the agent. That was the agreement. But then what happened is that the club owner wasn't Orlando Pirates, the club owner that owned me, and wasn't too sure about the agents that were involved, whatever. So he flew over, and next minute he went to the club, and they gave him the whole $2 million. So as a youngster, find myself sitting. The agent calls me and says, "Listen, yeah, they've taken all the money." I'm like, "Okay."
Not much you can do about it, really.
No. Should I fly back to South Africa and go? I feel sorry for myself, or it's just money. And fortunately, went on to play. Yeah, and then fortunately, I had the opportunity to move to the biggest club in UK. And that's correct.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's really interesting. Really, really interesting. Thanks, Mark.
I think it's fascinating, obviously, to be able to move from South Africa to Italy, new language, new culture, as you say, a very different style of football, I imagine, as well. But then, of course, you come to the Premier League with Bolton. I imagine that must have been another gear change for you, given the extra pace of the English game.
Yeah, for sure. I had the experience of when, I'm sure you remember, when South Africa played England at Old Trafford, and that's where Colin Todd saw me, and that's where he wanted, you know, that's where the conversation started. But coming to the English Premier League, I mean, that is, not because I'm talking to you guys, but it is the best league in the world. It really is. It is the pace that has been played, and now the quality of players that you have, it suited me better than the Italian league. I'm sure you remember or somehow the way I played football. I grew up as a striker playing in South Africa till the age of 17. When I signed for Cosmos, they signed me as a striker. And then we were playing what is our sort of FA Cup here in South Africa, Nedbank Cup. And then the central defender got sent off in the semi-final. And the coach said to me, okay, you go play the back. So I went to the back, and then the rest is history. So I've always, as a defender, wanted to be attacking. So the game, the faster the game, I think the better it suited me.
No, I've understood. What was Colin Todd like as a manager? Did you have a good relationship with him?
Yeah, I think we had a good enough, when I say good enough relationship, but he liked me as a player. But I think the issues of me playing for South Africa, going back and forth, I think it hampered. And I always found myself, you know, if I went to play for South Africa, whatever it was, a qualifier, whatever, I'd come back and I would actually never play that weekend. And so I don't know, you know, it's like you take it personally out for me, which is, yeah. But I got on well enough with him, and we played some good football. I think that year we got relegated. I think it was on goal difference.
Yeah, it was.
It was a disgrace, an absolute bloody disgrace.
I was going to say, Chris, I presumed you wanted to take the lead on the ghost goal of Jerry Taggart, but I imagine, Mark, that must have been horrible for the side to take, given that realistically we didn't deserve to go down that season at all.
Sure, and you know, it's that. And it, you, I mean, you spoke earlier about the players at Lazio, but Bolton, we had some fantastic players there, and
for
that to happen, it was, you know, and I distinctly remember because I had signed for Bolton. And I had to leave the UK to receive my work permit. And I came back. And then I think distinctively it's the game against Everton at the Reebok.
Mm-hmm. Where, that was the first game, yeah.
Yeah, but that was a game where, was it the goal was disallowed or allowed? And that's
it crossed the line. Don't let anybody tell you any different. The ball was miles over the line. But
exactly.
The stupid referee didn't see it.
That would have been 3 points. Or did we end up losing or did we draw?
I think it was just the fact that it was Everton. It was just the fact that it was Everton, and then obviously it comes the end of the season, and that's the team that we're in direct.
Had the goal been allowed as it should have been, we would have beaten Everton, and we would have survived with Everton going down.
So we actually drew the game, but if the goal was allowed, we would have won the game, so we would have had 2 points extra. Okay,
correct,
exactly that. But yeah, for me, the highlight was that again, you know, you mentioned earlier about Man United and my first game. My work flew over. It was against United at Old Trafford, and unbelievable. We drew 0-0. It was a fantastic occasion, and yeah, it's a fun memory. You know, again playing against a lot of people will say to me, "Well, why didn't you go to United?" But to play against them and have that result was a good result.
There was a couple of games that season. I'd just be interested to know if you've got any particular memories of. I know you've mentioned the United game. I'm interested in my primary memory from that is a fantastic on-pitch fight between two players. I think it was Nathan Blake and Pallister, I think, at United. And then the second game I remember very, very, very much from that season was when we got absolutely hammered from Sheffield Wednesday, when we were 4-0 down at half-time.
That was Jimmy Phillips' fault, though. That was Jimmy Phillips' fault.
That's right. That's right. Fights are fantastic. But from a player's point of view, any particular other memories of that season?
No, but that one, I mean, that Sheffield Wednesday game, exactly 4-0 down at half-time. You sit as a player, you sit in a change room, you think, oh, my gosh. You got De Canio. Who was the other one?
Andy Booth was the one who got the goals.
No, like De Canio, and who was the other Italian?
And Carbone.
Oh, by Carbone, yeah.
Carbone.
Oh, my gosh, they ripped us to pieces. And you're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself at halftime, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do now? But, I think, again, probably the memory would be the last game against Chelsea, isn't it? You know,
Yeah, they wanted us to score so desperately.
You're playing, yeah, we play, and yeah, I think, shoot, if I can remember, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but we sort of outplayed them, and you know, we just, and then you go in at halftime, and then, but you could hear, you know, the Bolton fans in the stadium, and you go, and you think to yourself, like, but yeah, I mean, I think definitely the United game for me, and then obviously for me as a player and moving to the UK and having watched, you know, the big teams, and unfortunately growing up, we only used to get the FA Cup final. So you would only watch, you'd watch United, FA Cup finals in the 80s were generally United, Liverpool, and maybe an Everton, and then you get the odd Wimbledon and freak show, but then that happened. So then to play Liverpool, we played Liverpool where, you know, at the Reebok Stadium, that was also, for me, a good experience.
Oh, you mentioned that. We were talking about this before with the Michael Owen Challenge, celebrated very, very heavily by the fans.
Absolutely. Remember it so clearly that Owen was in his absolute pomp at the time. You know, he was only a young lad, top speed, fastest player I'd ever seen in my life. And my memory might be playing tricks as well, Mark, but I'm sure that he had at least a 50-yard head start on you that you managed to catch him up on.
You know what? I've got goosebumps. You just made my day because I have exactly that same memory where I don't know about 50 yards, but he was in front of me, and luckily I was fortunate enough to run fast enough and use my long legs and scraping tackle just before he was about to shoot. So yeah, that is an absolute fond memory. That
It's absolutely brilliant. There's certain traits in certain players that's always been held dear to me. And I don't know if it was because growing up watching Bolton, we didn't have any particularly exotic players, you know. And then, you know, you came along with South African international, etc. And that move you had, you always seemed to be able at the very last second to hook the ball away with your foot on a slide tackle. I've never forgotten that. It's a fantastic memory.
No. Thank you. But obviously that year. But then, you know, we did have a lot of, you know, fantastic players come through Bolton in while I was there. And when you talk about, Klaus Jensen, obviously I had a good Johnson as well, but Klaus Jensen and fantastic players. And we had a fantastic team. I think we talk about that year in the Premier League, but I think for me, the hardest was the following year. You know, you get to Wembley, it's the playoff final against Watford, and I was fortunately the captain then, whatever, and you go out and play, and it was disappointing. I think that was the hardest for me to lose 2-0 to Watford.
Most definitely. At Wembley. Most definitely. There was one player, if you don't mind, then I'll hand you back to Tom. Just, I've always been interested to know what he was like as a person on the side. He only played a part role in that first scene, but was Arne Gunnlaugsson, the Icelandic forward that we had back in the day. I'm not sure if you remember him. He looked much like Ming the Merciless from Flash Gordon.
I do know exactly. Arne's a good lad. Yeah.
Was he like on the training ground? Because he was capable of the most amazing skills, and his career, it burned really, really bright for a couple of years, and then it just vanished into nothing.
Yeah, I think Arne was a fantastic individual. I think he loved life and people. I would tell him as well. It's not like I'm speaking bad about him, but if he was ice cream, he would lick himself because he loved himself. But he was a fantastic man. But like you said, he had fantastic skills. And I think that was probably for a lot of fans was the downfall of him was that he showed so much potential, but never really gave everything. And that's what it looked like. But Arne was the first guy I met when I signed for Bolton, and we stayed in the hotel together. So yeah,
he was a regular out on the party scene as well around town at that kind of time. He liked a night out.
He did. He should.
Fantastic. Brilliant.
You mentioned Gunnlaugsson as one of your teammates, Mark. I'm interested to know which of the other central defenders that you most enjoy playing alongside, because people who spring to mind from my perspective would be Bergson, Mike Whitlow, Jerry Taggart, other defenders like that.
So, I think I'm going to say Goodney is probably the best that I enjoyed the most, because, I mean, Goodney just was a solid defender. Jerry's just hardcore, and I love Jerry. So he would just it's difficult to separate any of them again. And then even Andy Todd, on his day, he played fantastic football. So there were some good, and Mike, you're right. Mike Whitlow played once or twice, played on left central defence. But we had really good defenders. But I'd probably say at Bolton, I'd probably say Goodney was probably the favourite because he was the most reliable and probably the most consistent of all of them.
Yeah, Goodney's obviously very, very fondly remembered by all of us. Obviously, as you say, very, very difficult to come into your first season expecting to be a Premier League footballer. You've got a good squad there that realistically should have been playing at that level. When you then did get relegated, and obviously you're now playing in Division One, having been at Lazio a couple of seasons before, did that take some getting used to?
So, I think for me, what the fortunate thing was, losing the playoff final to Watford, I fortunately went on to play for South Africa at our first World Cup, which was 98. Mm-hmm. So that is the disappointment of not being promoted. I think that helped a little bit. But again, coming back to the preseason, going back again, not really. Yes, you obviously want to be playing the Premier League, but the First Division, and which is now the Championship, is as if not even more competitive. You play so much more games. I think it took our team a little while to get used to it, in the sense that I think was it halfway through that season when Colin Todd left and then Sam Allardyce came?
Yes, in the November, yeah.
So I think that was the biggest challenge, because Big Sam himself was a big central defender and hardcore, kick the ball as far as you can and head the ball as far as you can. What I do respect for of him at the time is that, he inherited a team that wanted to play football. It wasn't a typical, let's kick the ball as far as we can, do this. And he tried to, his first training session, he stood on the halfway line and kicked the ball in the air, and we as defenders must run and header it as far as we could. So it's like, no, brother, this is not really going to happen for us. Let's get it done. And I think it probably took Sam 2-3 months, and he realized the sort of players he has, and he grew into that. So, and then again, that's year, the second year with Sam is what we lost to Ipswich in the semi-finals of the...
Which another was a disgrace. Game.
Yeah. What was it? 7 goals.
Something like that. But we had such a technical squad that season, with Jensen, Franson, Johansson, yourself, Gunnlaugsson, Sellers, Gardner, etc., that... It was pointless to play that kind of football. You had some quality players there. But moving on to that Ipswich game, I'll let Tom talk you through the numbers in that one, because I'll just get angry.
Well, I think just talk about the playoffs in general. I think, as you said, it sort of characterises your time at the club, Mark. I imagine they're just such a high-pressure thing that to have it taken away from you like that in the way that Barry Knight did is just horrible to experience.
So, exactly. So Wembley was my worst stadium because, again, wasn't it... Unfortunately, I missed out again because of the African Nations Cup in 2000. I missed out on the League Cup semi-final, but the FA Cup semi-final against Villa at Wembley, losing on penalties, man.
And another one.
Shouldn't have even got to penalties if Holdsworth could bloody finish.
Let's not go there. Let's not go there.
No, it's
in the World Cup in 1998, Mark, did you come up against Franson for Denmark? I know you were in the same group, weren't you?
Sorry, what's that?
Sorry, I beg your pardon. When you played in the World Cup with South Africa in 98, Per Franson would have been playing for the Danish team in that first round. Did you come up against one another?
I did, but I don't think Per was playing. I think he was on the
bench. Was he a sub? Okay.
Yeah,
fair enough.
I think he was sub because you had the Laudrup brothers and yeah. So, I think he was on the bench. But,
fair enough.
The other day, and if we could have just won that game, then anyway, let's pass. Let's not.
No, it's fair enough. I'm looking at the Ipswich game now. Finished 5-3, and we had two people sent off in the space of seven minutes. Do you still look back on that night with hatred towards Barry Knight, or have you been able to let it go? Unlike most of us.
Okay, let's move on. We can let it go, but if you look back and you think, I think it was comical what happened that evening. It's just, we went and I think most Bolton fans went, what was the result at home?
2-2, I think.
Yeah.
Was it 2-2 at home? So, yeah. Okay. So they had a good chance to, but I think we went there with optimism and I think the refereeing wasn't the best, unfortunately. And but we look at ourselves and then unfortunately we didn't do, but I think that that probably was a bigger disappointment for me than losing the year before in the playoff final.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we should have even been in the playoffs? Do you think there was a quality in that squad to get us up automatically?
In the playoffs?
No, I'm saying, we're in the playoffs for those 2 years, but I think we probably had the quality in that squad to be able to go up automatically regardless.
Both years, certainly. But that second year, I remember with being 2000 and we were still back and forth. We weren't on the same page as FIFA and that. And I think the championship, how many teams in the championship? Yeah.
24. 24.
So 23. So that's 46 games. I remember Klaus Jensen telling me that because of his games that he was playing for Denmark and this, he at one stage had played 64 games in that calendar year. In the football calendar year. So, and I probably was the same. So, yeah, we certainly did have the quality of squad to go up automatically. But yeah, unfortunately, it didn't happen.
It's a dreadful shame. How difficult was it on sort of the squad's morale? Because it seemed like you had a very good dressing room at that time. It must have been difficult to cope with two successive playoff losses.
Yeah. It's you had. I think Allardyce was key to having the morale good. The players themselves. I think that was, again, like I said, that probably was, if not the biggest disappointment in my football career for that night at Ipswich, because I know that if we had got through that, we would have certainly got on.
Yeah, dreadful shame, isn't it? It's just looking back at it and what might have been almost. Look as well, of course, going into that 2000-2001 season, again, as you'd be a mainstay right at the start, and then it seemed as though the financial pressures that were on the club after moving to the new stadium and not getting promoted seemed to really hit hard. How much of that were you made aware of as a player?
So I don't think as much, but you just play football and you do what you need to do. I don't think everything was really told to us as players. And I just think that it all came at one shot. And suddenly affected everyone.
Yeah, it's like I said, you weren't the only player who was almost forced out. Was there ever any idea in your mind that you wanted to leave Bolton? Obviously, you ended up at Charlton going with Klaus Jensen. I wasn't sure if that was almost forced upon you rather than something you wanted to happen.
So, the sad thing is that when we lost that Ipswich a playoff, my agent said to me, okay, well, and I think Charlton got promoted, obviously, that year. And then he said to me, Charlton interested. And then I went down and had a medical with Charlton in the off-season. And unfortunately, through a month of injuries or not ever having the ACL done, but there was so much wear and tear on my knees, Charlton said, no, they're not going to take that chance. But they said to the agent, okay, well, let's monitor him. And unfortunately, once that had happened, me and Sam sort of fell out because, Sam wanted me to sign a new deal. And it was never, and again, I'm not being a typical footballer, it's not about money, but if I'm playing in the championship and it's going to be the third year in a row, I'd rather be wanting, if there is an opportunity, you want to be playing in the best league against the best players.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
And, unfortunately, Sam, he put a lot of pressure on me, and me and him just didn't see eye to eye. And even at training sessions, and I think still at the time I could have been captain. And then, and distinctively remember we were playing Birmingham away at Birmingham, obviously. And I think with about 15 or 20 minutes, I can't remember the result. I think we ended up winning anyway. But 15, 20 minutes to go, you subbed me, and Sam had never done it before, and up me, and that was the Saturday, and the Sunday night I got the phone call and said, listen, yeah, you can go to Charlton.
It's a shame that it sort of had to end that way, but it would be completely remiss of me to not talk about how disappointed the fans would have felt at that time, given you were such a cult hero. Chris, do you want to shout fish or shall I or what?
No, but I'll tell you what I will say. My mum is very disappointed with you, Mark. She spent £12 on a hat for me when I was about 14, and I only ever wore it three or four times. A big, stupid fish-shaped hat. I begged her to buy it for me.
Nah, it's a cool hat. It's not a stupid hat. But anyway,
I'll have to. It's a shame this isn't a video podcast. I could have dug it out and worn it.
But I think, you know, Bolton was such a good club. The fans were so good to me. I've got fantastic memories. And as you said there, unfortunately, the way that I left the club, So the Saturday, got substituted. The Sunday, I can go down. So I said to the kid guy, listen, I'm going to come to the training ground and say goodbye to players. And unfortunately, Sam was, I think, so disappointed in me that I was leaving the club, or whatever you want to call it, that he didn't allow me to train again. This kid guy actually came and gave my boots to me, and then I left. So I never had the chance to say goodbye to the players.
Such a shame. It seems, and we've obviously done podcasts with quite a few players over the last couple of months or so, that once you're not his player, it's almost like Sam's pastoral care towards them just ends. And it's quite horrible to see a man who's so revered at Bolton almost, treat people like commodities rather than people.
Yeah. But anyway, such is life.
Exactly. What do you have any particular brilliant memories with the fans? You have one that sticks out for you?
Sure, no. I think Bolton fans, I'm going to probably say, there's probably the one when playing in the first division or championship, whatever you want to call it. We played against Grimsby. And obviously,
I remember this.
Fishing town. And next minute, fans were singing, "There's only one fish in Grimsby." So yeah, Bolton fans were very good to me. So, but I distinctly remember that there's only one fish in Grimsby. So sure. Always good to me, and I have fond memories, and I'm very grateful for, as you said there earlier about the hat. They just took to me like they did to all the other players as well. But yeah, it was a phenomenal experience, and it's Bolton itself, the city, the town. Yeah, I've got fond memories, and I remember every single thing that I did there. So I love it, and I miss it.
Have you been able to come back in recent years?
Sorry.
No, yes. I was going to say, I wouldn't imagine you would do.
No,
we spoke to Riley Jaidi, who's obviously from Tunisia, and he said he absolutely couldn't stand the weather in Bolton.
So I don't mind the rain, but, that drizzle for 2 weeks, that's not happening. Sure.
Much better to be back in South Africa from that perspective, I would be sure. I mentioned sort of at the top of the podcast how, influential you were in helping to get the 2010 World Cup to South Africa. I imagine that must be one of the things that also sticks out in your memory as a real high point for you as well.
No, certainly. To have experienced what we did here in South Africa on the African continent, for sure, it's something that it's fond memory. But unfortunately, having had the World Cup here and having all the fans around the world and having the best players in the world come play here, I think it's, if you look at what has happened from our football since, the memories are the best thing. But our football, I think that it's the World Cup for 2 or 3 years after the World Cup did a lot for us. But people forget quickly and people want to do less and do whatever suits them. So I think the unfortunate World Cup, if I look back now, it's a 50-50. 50% for me is unbelievable. The other 50 is what it's done to our football and how they think and what they do. So there's pros and cons, but unfortunately, fortunately, I'll focus on the pros.
Fantastic. It's just so interesting just to hear the insight, not only for your playing experience over here, but the experiences you've had since. Just a couple of bits then, but I guess before we bring things to a close, I'd be curious to know, do you have any particular memories of playing in England in terms of who your toughest opponent was? I mean, around that sort of time, it was in the pomp of, Robbie Fowler, people like Michael Owen, like we've already discussed, Shearer. Anyone in particular that comes to mind?
So, again, you had Shearer, but and then you have Thierry Henry, you have those players, but then you have a big Scotsman that just, first ball that comes in the air, he's a striker and he elbows you in the face and you're like, what are you doing, buddy? It's just a football. Big Dunk Ferguson. That was a big Dunk Ferguson was a
wow.
But they're all experiences. I mean, I don't want to sound cliche here, but as a footballer, you want to play against the hardest, the best players. And so it's all fond memories. But there's no player that I would say that, oh, gosh, we're playing in so-and-so and he's playing. No, there's no play like that. I think that, again, the English league, you know, having the top players and having the excitement of the way of football, that's what you want to compete against. So,
of course.
And there's no one that I ever feared, but obviously respected, obviously, a lot of players. But, yeah, it's fond memories.
There's one final question for me, then, if you don't mind. It's back to your South African days. There's always been a player who's fascinated me since day one, purely down to his name. Did you ever play with Dr. Khumalo?
I did. No, I played with Dr. Khumalo. He's not a doctor, so let me just tell you. He's actually such a softy where, yeah, but Dr. Khumalo, and we unfortunately, we had of the 96 team, the late John Macheo. You know, you put a ball at those individuals' feet, and they do unbelievable things that you stand there amazed, and they just gifted. So I played with Dr. Khumalo, and he's a fantastic footballer with the ball at his feet.
He's always a fascinating character for me growing up. Like, so it was around that sort of time when you came to Bolton, and around the time the sort of night, the World Cups, that I would see these players play. Always, and you say about John Mashu, always known his shoes. Always, yeah. Remember these names when in my sort of formative years watching football. Fantastic, thank you.
Yeah, no. So in 96, when you're talking about it, so we would have a fan come with a stethoscope, holding a shoe with a tin of pultures in it. So that's obviously supporting me, Dr. Mollis shoes and fish. But anyway,
see, the fish hat's not as daft as it sounds, is it? I guess
not at all.
It's an essential piece of fashion, Chris, I think.
Wonderful. I'm going to have to find it, I think. It'd be in my mum's house somewhere.
Yeah, I think what I'd ask you also, Mark, seeing as we're talking about South African football, there are there any players that you know of at the moment that we should be looking out for making it big in the coming years?
So, it's difficult for me. I don't... It might be a shock to you guys. I don't really watch football. I do... football projects on the farms in the Limpopo. So what I've come up with is a shortened version of football. So we have IPL cricket, T20 cricket, you have sevens rugby. We don't have anything in football. So what I've done is I do it on the farms here in South Africa, and when I eventually get it to the under 15 level. So I do a shortened version of football, which is 20 minutes a half, still full size, 11v11, and then at the flick of a coin, you select when you want a 5-minute power play. And in that 5-minute power play, you take three players off the field. So it becomes 10v7. So when you're thinking of under 15 level, 10v7. So now we want to create, to make the game quicker, make the game more exciting. But also one of our biggest challenges in South Africa and probably on the continent to a degree is that we don't shoot outside the 18-yard area. So now if you score outside the 18-yard area, it counts as two.
Oh, really?
So,
okay.
So
interesting.
It makes the game quicker. So there certainly are players out there that, but I can't really, to be 100%, I don't follow the league. I follow whatever happens. But I'm trying to change the way the people of South Africa think about football. So what we do is, there's no extra time, straight to penalties. Penalties are on the 18-yard area. On the semicircle, you put the ball on the line, you have to hit the crossbar with our goalkeeper. So what we're trying to do is not only make the game quicker, make players better, skills improvement, improve the coaching, and again, I think the most important thing is to improve the knowledge of a football fan.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you the best of luck with it, Mark. I think it's fantastic what you're doing out there. And like I say, let's hope that soon normality can come back and we can get back to, you know, doing what we all do best and hopefully watching some football.
Yes, for sure. And let's hope that Bolton can pull a rabbit out the hat.
Absolutely. I'll just ask before we close this out, Mark, do you have any message for the Bolton fans? We had a fantastic response on Twitter when we told people that you were coming on. Lots of questions and a lot of people just shouting, "Fiche."
No. I just want to say to them that, you know, thank you very much for all their support and everything that they gave me as a player there. Not only at Bolton, but you know, in the UK when I played football there, and fond memories. And Bolton, especially Bolton, was like a second home away from home.
Brilliant! It's good to hear that you still got a bit of fond memories for the club, because the fans certainly still have fond memories for you. Thank you very much, Mark, for your
thank
time.
You very
it's
much,
been a
guys.
Been a fantastic chat, and thank you to you, Chris, as well, for coming on and helping with
anytime.
My sort of gaps in my 90s knowledge. Thank you for listening, everyone, to the Ilana Vienna Street Podcast, episode 144, with special guest Mark Fiche.
Thank you, gentlemen.